workers often work in very difficult conditions because of the kind of societal strictures and norms that exist. Many frontline workers often struggle to advocate for themselves and improve these conditions.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. We often talk about providing not just jobs, but decent jobs in developing countries. But in many parts of the world, workers still have incredibly harsh working conditions. There have been interventions at the firm level to create safer workplaces, better health, higher job satisfaction. But have they succeeded? And probably importantly for the sustainability of these interventions, do they also raise productivity? In our latest collaboration with Jay Pell to discuss Jay Pell's policy insights, I'm talking to Ach Advario of UC San Diego about a review that he and his co-authors have written on the research into worker well-being. Ach, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Ach, what is the problem here that these interventions are trying to solve?
Well, this is a perennial problem with the relationship between employers and workers. Historically, it was true in currently high-income countries, and for many low-income countries today, it remains the case that workers often work in very difficult conditions. They face a lot of problems in workplaces around harassment and poor treatment from their superiors. They face harsh conditions around the working environment, so polluted, hot places in particular. And often because of the kind of societal strictures and norms that exist, many frontline workers often struggle to advocate for themselves and improve these conditions. Part of the problem that we're talking about in this review is the conditions that exist in workplaces. I think it's also broader issues that exist for low-income populations in general that then manifest in the workplace. So, for example, people who don't have a lot of income also have poor nutrition or have poor financial inclusion and don't have a lot of options for their families, are often disempowered in other ways. And so those problems also show up in the workplace. And that's also what we're trying to address in this body of work.
It's really important to think about the lives of people who are working in these jobs. But when we're thinking about the interventions, the sorts of things we're going to be talking about today, is it also important that there is a benefit for employers as well?
That's a good question. I think if the goal is poverty alleviation and the improvement of the well-being and overall utility of workers, I think that the most immediate outcomes that we should be thinking about are related to those factors. So the health of individuals, their financial inclusion, their income, et cetera. I think the point that we make in a lot of this research and what we try to emphasize in this review is that often the interests of businesses are implicated in the improvement of well-being through workplaces. So simply put, businesses don't tend to do things that don't affect their bottom lines in a positive way. That's really a core tenet of economics that, you know, businesses are going to do things that they feel are going to be profit enhancing. So tying the well-being of workers to the profit or the bottom line of firms is then necessary if we think that workplaces are a way to intervene to actually improve the well-being of workers. So if we want to do that in a sustainable and wide-scale manner, then we have to think about the interest of businesses.
We often think about this in high-income countries as something that is the government's job of doing, introduce some regulation, tell businesses how to treat their workers. I note that what we're talking about today are interventions at the firm level rather than those legal or regulatory steps.
Yeah, it's an interesting take on this work. A lot of the policy literature in this space has focused on how do we regulate businesses so they're not doing the wrong things, right? And that works to a certain extent. Actually, when you're thinking about global value chains, which a lot of the businesses that this review focuses on are part of, the regulations in one part of the world actually end up impacting what businesses can and can't do in other parts of the world. So I think that's an important lever and one that will continue to be important because firms really respond to the incentives that they're given by the government. government or by the broader ecosystem. But the point we're trying to make here is that for certain types of intervention and programming for workers, it may be the case that those things are good for the workers themselves, but also end up being just intrinsically good investments for the firm. Just like I would invest in upgrading my equipment, for example, to get a greater efficiency or productivity, maybe I should be investing in upgrading the well-being and the skills and the lives of my workers, because I get a return from that that has nothing to do with their well-being necessarily, but only really comes down to profit. So that's what we try to focus on in this review, is that in some cases, well-being improvements can actually translate into productivity or profit-related improvements as well. And so that sets up a dual incentive for firms to invest.
We'll be back in a moment.
My name is Oliver Hanney. I'm the managing editor here at VoxDev, and I'm here to give our VoxDevlets a short plug. We now have 14 available on our website and the same amount currently underway. VoxDevlets from VoxDev are easy to read, policy-oriented literature reviews that will help you to stay informed. In each VoxDevlet, experts in their field distill the evidence on important questions in development economics.
What's interesting is that it is actually trying to do different things.
Every time we answer a question, it raises one or two more.
From agriculture to trade, from bureaucracy to mobile money, VoxDevlets are open access, accessibly written, policy-focused and regularly updated. Find them at voxdev.org/voxdevlet.
This is a really interesting set of questions. It opens up a whole can of worms.
And stay tuned for our upcoming release on electricity infrastructure and an update to our VoxDevlet on the informal sector.
Ash, what type of research are you considering in this review?
So a lot of the work that we look at in this review comes from the economics literature, and in keeping with J-PAL's commitment to causal impact evaluation, we have focused on studies that have well-identified treatment effects on well-being, and we're going to define that in particular ways, and business outcomes. And so the majority of the work that we present in this review is randomized controlled trials in sort of real life firm environments. And then we have a few quasi-experimental studies as well, which have a high bar for causality in the estimation of these treatment effects, even though they're not fully randomized.
Let's start with safety. What sort of interventions have you reviewed that make work safer? What is the evidence that they are making work safer?
Safety is obviously a huge issue all around the world. The ILO estimates something like 3 million workers die every year because of unsafe workplaces. So thinking about safety, particularly in global value chains, is incredibly important. Often buyers impose safety standards through audits and other mechanisms onto their suppliers, who largely operate in the global south. But those audits and other mechanisms only go so far to guarantee safety. And so there's a really nice study by Laura Boudreaux in Bangladesh looking at enhancing the participation of workers in these safety mechanisms. And what she finds is when you encourage firms to upgrade their safety standards and hold the firm management accountable by having worker-led committees that guarantee that safety, you actually find that safety improves, and as a result, workers are better off. This is one example of a way in which worker involvement and worker voice can lead to better outcomes for workers when they have the ability to communicate directly with firm management. There's also a quasi-experimental study from Myanmar, which finds, again, consistent with this, that when firms are linked with global value chains and are exporting to global buyers, in particular in the global north, that kind of supply chain pressure can actually improve worker safety.
Yes, that is an interesting conclusion, isn't it? Because very often in the global north, we hear criticisms of these firms as exploiting a lack of standards, a lack of safety standards, because they're just thinking about the prices.
Right.
But what we see from this evidence is that their pressure can really make a difference.
Correct. And I think the key thing here is that it's probably not just the pressure alone, but also some buy-in from suppliers themselves.
Right.
And what we saw with Laura's work is that if you increase the participation and the voice of workers in these firms, that's when you really translate into an impact. I think another really remarkable finding in her work is that the positive impacts on worker safety are really focused on the firms, the factories that were well managed to start with. Mm-hmm. Some people believe that intervening in the worse off firms is probably the best thing to do because, you know, any improvement is good. I think what she shows counterintuitively is that it's only when you really have proper managerial structures and general managerial quality in place that you can actually improve your outcomes through these external stimuli. So upgrading managerial quality is something that's also really important to get the conditions right for these reforms to work.
Well, talking of getting conditions right, the working environment affects the health of workers. Have there been studies on the impact of improving that working environment?
The working environment is obviously incredibly important, especially in low-income countries. Mm-hmm. Often these manufacturing hubs in particular, where large factories are located, are extremely polluted, many times above the WHO standards for air quality. They are at particular times of the year and, you know, summers, et cetera, are reaching 40 to 50 degrees Celsius, incredibly, incredibly hot. And both of those problems are exacerbated when you have machines doing stuff on the factory floor, producing both pollution as well as heat and noise. And so those conditions are likely going to impact productivity and the health of workers in dramatic ways. And so there are a raft of studies that we take a look at in this review, finding excessive heat and excessive pollution both have negative productivity impacts, likely through the channel of affecting workers' physical ability to work, as well as the cognitive focus that workers have, and that actually improving those conditions can lead to substantial gains in productivity. So that's true for heat, that's true for air pollution, it's also true for noise pollution, which is actually an often ignored one, but important for the ability of workers to really focus. And I think there's still work to be done in this space. I think one of the open questions is really the magnitude of these impacts. So it makes sense that we would improve productivity by lowering pollution levels, but how much of a gain do you get for certain reductions? And is that curve linear, or are there certain places where we can really make inroads in productivity and health gains? Those questions are still to be answered.
Now, for quite a few years, the role of unions, worker organizations, has been something of a fringe topic in economics, not much discussed. We've seen more research on it lately. In these contexts, is it a factor? Is it perhaps a route to improving worker conditions?
On the role of unions, I think a lot of that work has been focused historically in the U.S. Lots of studies in the 80s and 90s. This is not, of course, experimental, randomized prospective work, but rather observational studies, essentially looking at the impact of unions on things like worker wages and productivity. There's a recent interest in this from the development economics space, and we cover a bunch of the related papers in our review. But in most low-income country contexts, unions are not powerful factors that sway the interests of business. Collective action is still pretty weak in a lot of these contexts. And so there are structures within the firm that replace or partially play the role that a union would play for collective bargaining by representing the voice of workers. But often that voice is small, it's muffled. There's very few conduits to get grievances properly addressed. And that has huge implications for worker well-being, for the workplace environment in general, for workers' ability to advocate for themselves. And in most places, frontline workers, low-income workers, and women in particular struggle to have agency. So there's a bunch of work that I and my co-authors have done in this space to look at improving the ability for frontline workers to communicate anything, grievances, suggestions for improvement, et cetera, up to management, and then having those grievances and suggestions addressed appropriately and in a timely manner. In my work, we focus on creating that conduit through a simple technology that allows workers to communicate grievances anonymously and have a kind of a two-way conversation with HR that can be anonymous if need be. What we find is that when you do this, worker satisfaction with the workplace improves. They're less likely to leave the firm. They're less likely to be absent on any given day. And in the final trial that we've just finished, we find that when you actually provide HR with incentives for appropriately addressing the grievances that come through, This results in a productivity gain as well, which is then shared by workers through higher incomes compensation.
It's interesting the role of anonymity in this to be able to protect workers, I guess, because much of their employment is insecure.
Absolutely. I think anonymity is a critical piece here. And in all of our work that comes through, if you don't prove to workers that their communications can remain anonymous, even if you make the technology super easy, super accessible, they still won't use it because there's a lack of trust. So first, you have to instill this idea that you can remain anonymous and that you won't have a manager or a supervisor take actions against you for speaking up.
Actually, I notice also in this brief that you cover training, the role of training. How we talk about training fairly regularly on VoxDev Talks, but it's nearly always about training people so they can get into jobs, so they can find employment in the first place. What role does it have in improving working conditions for people who already have a job?
Well, it's interesting you say that because actually a lot of the training literature that focuses on, say, unemployed individuals or unemployed youth in particular, there's been a lot of push on that around the world. Really, those results are quite mixed in terms of the ability for training to actually make a difference in employment probabilities and the quality of jobs that people get. It stands in contrast with what we know from on-the-job training, and there's been some really nice work in the recent years that has focused in particular on training people in soft skills. So things like communication, teamwork, leadership, the kinds of skills that are not only applicable to any particular position, but would apply for many positions that a worker could take up and also might spill over onto other parts of their lives, the way they communicate with their families, their partners, etc. And so I've done some work in this space with Anant Naishadam and Namrata Kala that focused on providing soft skills training for female garment workers. Mm-hmm. And there we saw substantial improvements in soft skills like collaboration and teamwork. And those skills then translated into greater productivity. So even for these frontline workers who are stitching garments or working on a production line, the general idea is that these workers may not see productivity improvements from gaining soft skills because they're just doing a technical job. But it turns out to be untrue. They actually generate quite a lot of improvement by working together with the folks on the line with them, by collaborating, by speaking up. We find pretty large productivity improvements on the order of 18 to 20%. In that study. We also have studied further up the chain the soft skills of managers. So supervisors on production lines, especially in low-income contexts, tend to be very negatively characterized. They shout at their workers. They're verbally harassing people, especially in industry like garments, where most of the frontline workers are women. Mm-hmm. Most of the managers of those workers are men. Yeah. There's this inherent gender dynamic that plays out negatively, or you have instances of sexual harassment as well. There's lots of room to intervene there to improve the soft skills of these managers. And one of the key things that we worked on in that trial was improving emotional regulation. What we noticed was that the same pressure that these managers apply to their own workers, they're actually getting that pressure from further up the chain because of production pressures being very high, the amount of production that needs to be done in a given day being very intense. They've got people breathing down their necks. Instead of absorbing that and being able to translate it calmly into production, the instinct is, I'm being yelled at, I'm under pressure, I'm going to yell at my workers to get things done. So we tried to break that chain in this trial, and we found that providing those frontline managers with skills to cope with the emotional ups and downs of the production day, to communicate effectively with workers, to lead their team, resulted in quite a lot of productivity gain as well.
This is very encouraging work, improving working lives. We've mentioned several times that these interventions improve productivity. So as an economist, you might ask, why are the employers not doing these things already?
Maybe we should ask ourselves, first of all, do employers notice the differences in these trials enough to change the compensation or the way that they treat the workers who have, say, increased skill or who have worked faster on their line? We can measure, because of our very careful measurement, that productivity went up by 4%, but can a supervisor standing around see that productivity improvement on that magnitude? That's an open question. And actually, across these different categories, we find that sometimes firms do reward workers for their increased productivity through increased compensation, either by bonuses that relate to performance or by increasing their level of promotion or the level of grade of skill, et cetera. But sometimes they don't. So for example, in the soft skills trial I mentioned earlier with female garment workers, we found a huge productivity improvement, but a very small wage improvement. So those productivity gains were not translated to wages. The two questions, what you asked about whether firms take these interventions up, I think relates first to how much of a gain is created relative to the increased wage I have to pay. And then it relates, I think, to other factors that may not directly relate to the gain I would experience. So in that latter case, what we've noticed is that a lot of the firms we've worked with, when we finish the trial, there's a lot of interest once they see the results for themselves in scaling up to other factory units within their firm, or basically to make this available to all workers, not just the experimental sample. And we've seen this across a lot of different interventions, that once we demonstrate these productivity impacts or other types of gains, firms are really interested and they do scale things up. But I think that personalized experience is sometimes needed. So when we, in other contexts with an NGO I helped found called Good Business Lab, we often take a lot of these insights we generate in research and we try to advocate for them across the entire industry. We directly approach a lot of firms and say, hey, here are our results. We found that programs X, Y, and Z are really successful at improving productivity. So would you like to adopt them? And a lot of times firms say, this is great to know. We'll take it under consideration or something like that. The information's out there, but really what you need is tactile, hands-on experience of a program before actually running it. Sometimes the CEO says, this sounds like a great program. Let's go ahead and implement it. But three rungs down the chain, the person who actually has to implement it sees this just as a bunch of extra work that he or she has to do. That's going to limit the ability of firms to really take up unless you get those incentives right. There's actually very little work on this in the economics profession. It needs to be much more of an agenda around how do you actually get firms to take up the stuff that we're finding to be successful. So I think step one is create the menu, find things that are actually successful through rigorous evaluation. And then step two is figure out how to unlock these gains for lots of firms by advocating in the right ways. There's actually a nice analog to this. Gautam Rao and others have worked in Latin America on providing information about various gains to public programming to elected officials and looking at how they take those programs up in their districts. And that's really valuable work because part of what it shows is that you can actually influence decision-making, at least at the public official level, but you have to communicate your findings and your insight in the right way for it to be taken up. So I think we can learn the same sort of lessons with firms, and that research is still to be done. So that's another mountain to climb over.
So I was very struck by your story of the workplace in which the people who get shouted at are mostly women and the people doing the shouting are mostly men. A story that I imagine hundreds of billions of people around the world can relate to. Is there evidence that improving workplace conditions can improve the experience of work for women in particular?
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of evidence that we've generated focuses on women. So my work in particular, it really zooms in on the experience of women in low-income settings. One, because there's obviously an important, interesting group per se, and we think that we can potentially affect some broader goals around women's economic empowerment by intervening in workplaces. But two, because I think women struggle with issues outside the workplace as well. So women tend to be more financially disempowered, tend to have less ability to speak out and have agency within their homes as well as within the workplace, et cetera. So intervening in the workplace to address those particular issues might then also have this broader societal implication, which makes it all the more interesting and worthwhile to study. So we have found in a lot of our work that improving financial inclusion, soft skills, worker voice, all of these things, when targeted towards women in particular, really can result in large gains. There's been some really nice work by Laura Boudreau again in Bangladesh, looking at ways to empower women to report workplace abuse. She finds that using a particular kind of reporting mechanism, you can actually generate huge increases in the reporting of workplace physical harassment, sexual harassment, just by changing the manner in which things are reported. And again, anonymity or being part of a crowd in reporting plays a big role in that. There's also really nice work in Bangladesh from another team, Rocco Machiavello and Chris Woodruff and co-authors, looking at how to identify and promote women as managers. Because as I mentioned, in this workplace dynamic where you have most of the frontline workers being women and most of their managers being men, you're setting yourself up for failure in a lot of ways. But one of the ways is that women don't feel that they have any promotion possibilities in this context. Obviously, just looking at the composition of your supervisors being mostly men, how could you infer that anything else is the case? So that group of authors designed and piloted a program that particularly trained women workers to take on the supervisory roles. Initially, there's a lot of resistance, but over time, you can overcome the discriminatory beliefs that people hold in the workplace about the ability of women to do this. That's a really powerful finding that relates not only to empowering women in frontline roles, but then also moving up the chain and saying there's career possibilities and income possibilities from staying in the workplace.
Considering how much time people spend at work, how important it is to their well-being, I'm surprised there isn't more research. The work that you and Chris and Rocco and Laura are doing, it's fascinating. Should we have more of it?
Absolutely. I think the point of this review is to, part, to encourage more work in this space. I think the bigger the menu we have of things that work, the more likely it is that we'd be able to generate wide-scale impact. While we know a bunch on things like voice and soft skills, I think there's a lot of work to be done on different areas of well-being improvement. For example, we don't know that much yet on different aspects of health. In particular, mental health is a big determinant of well-being that could be studied to a much greater degree in workplaces. We don't know much about the incentives that govern whether these programs get taken up in the first place, as I mentioned before. So I think it's really, really important for more study in this space. We shouldn't be afraid to fail as well, because what is equally important is a menu of things that don't tend to work. Often workplaces, even with the best intentions who want this kind of programming, are going in blind and aren't able to actually have this rubric or menu in front of them that tells them what works and what doesn't. So I think the more we can fill that out, the better we'll be.
And also we want research to influence policy and to influence which policy levers are pulled. Can policymakers be doing more, even at the moment, with what we know to influence the ways in which employers make the working lives of their employees better?
Absolutely. I think that policy involvement is critical. And going back to something you said early on in our conversation, I think we shouldn't ignore the powerful role that government can play in nudging firms to do the right thing through subsidies, through experimentation, through tax incentives, through penalties. Sometimes firms will adopt on their own, and sometimes they'll need government to help show them the way through all those levers. So I think that the government role is sort of undeniable here as well, even though we're focusing on business decision making. The other thing I should mention is a lot of the stuff that we've studied in implementation phase, sort of once it's been developed, is actually quite low cost. So for firms to take up the soft skills intervention that we have developed, or for firms to take up this promotion program that Rocco and Chris and co-authors worked on, it's a handbook or a training of trainers, that sort of thing. And so the returns are quite large for firms to do that. But the initial research is often a heavy lift, and the initial development of the program into something that can actually have impact. Sometimes we may need government to seed those efforts by developing key programming in these spaces that can then be circulated at fairly low cost once it's out there in the ether.
Thank you for your work. Thank you for talking about it. Thanks for putting the brief together as well, Ash.
It was a pleasure, and thanks for the conversation.
So look out for this brief on worker well-being, and there are also briefs on similar topics at www.povertyactionlab.org. You'll be able to find it. Go to the site and search there. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review. Tell someone else about us as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.